You're listening to Clinical Conversations, a Journal Watch podcast. It's for the week ending October 16th, and it's podcast number 61. Joe Elia here. This time we talk with Dr. Susan Mitchell, who discusses her paper on the clinical course of advanced dementia. First, this review of the week's principal clinical news stories. Giving acetaminophen to reduce the chance of fever after childhood vaccinations does succeed, but at the price of a lower immunogenicity from the vaccines. The researchers and an accompanying editorial in The Lancet say the practice of using antipyretics routinely in this circumstance should stop. Next, it may be that nursing home residents who require hemodialysis are already in decline. A study in the New England Journal of Medicine finds that almost two-thirds of those who started hemodialysis sustained reduced functional status or had died by the three-month mark. By 12 months, that proportion was up to almost 90%. Finally, minimally invasive radical prostatectomy, a very popular approach these days, leads to higher levels of urinary incontinence and erectile dysfunction, according to a study in JAMA. The procedure went from about 10% prevalence in 2003 to over 40% by 2007. Now, on to the interview. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. This week's New England Journal of Medicine features a piece of original research on the clinical course of advanced dementia. Researchers followed over 300 patients and their healthcare proxies during the 18-month study. They found a very high mortality rate and some surprising data about how informing the patient's proxy can make his or her final days easier. Dr. Susan Mitchell, the paper's first author, has kindly agreed to talk with us today. Dr. Mitchell is an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a senior scientist at the Hebrew Senior Life Institute for Aging Research, both in Boston. Welcome, Dr. Mitchell.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you why it was necessary to characterize dementia's course. I would have guessed it's pretty well known.
Well, dementia affects over 5 million Americans. That number is going to triple in the next 40 years, and it is a leading cause of death in the United States, but surprisingly little is known about how these patients die. You know, there's also been a general under-recognition of dementia as a terminal illness, and prior work has shown that their palliative care has been suboptimal, and one of the reasons for that may be for this lack of characterization of the end stage of this disease.
So you were just trying to get a definitive clinical profile of the end stages of dementia then?
That's right.
What were the factors that had a particularly serious prognosis?
Well, I want to underscore that the nursing home residents with end-stage dementia that we characterized were defined as having such profound memory deficits they couldn't recognize their own family members. They spoke fewer than six words, were bedbound, and totally dependent on others for their care and incontinent. So that's the characterization of the residents that we followed. And we found over 18 months there was a very high mortality rate, which was about 55% over 18 months, which is not dissimilar to other more commonly recognized end-stage diseases such as metastatic cancer. They frequently experienced infections, and the majority developed an eating problem. In fact, those complications could be considered a hallmark of the end stage of the disease. Far too many experienced distressing symptoms such as pain and shortness of breath, which increased in frequency as the patient approached the end of life. They also, 41%, underwent at least one burdensome intervention, which included a ER visit or a hospitalization, tube feeding, or intravenous therapy. 41% experienced at least one of those interventions as they approached the end of life. However, you know, when we interviewed their family members, those family members, patients of family members who had a better understanding of the clinical course of dementia and its poor prognosis, their loved ones were far less likely to undergo such burdensome interventions.
Yep, that was quite interesting. And what is that about? I mean, is it about setting the expectations in the family members, or is it about their having a say in whether their patient goes to the ER or undergoes the tube feedings?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I think that clearly families who were aware and had better expectations about what the end of this disease would look like, and in fact that their loved one was near the end of life, were more likely to opt for comfort care. And in fact, it's probably true that those families that had those perceptions also more likely to have conversations with their loved ones' providers about what type of care they want for their patient as they approach the end stage.
And those providers, or the physicians, I should say, often enough had not had conversations about prognosis with the proxies. Is that fair to say?
Right. We found that most patients' families did not receive any prognostic counseling from the physicians. Some were given some counseling about the expected clinical complications, but interestingly enough, the fact of whether they actually had this counseling or not was not associated with the receipt of burdensome interventions. It was the actual perceptions that the family member took away in terms of prognosis and expected complications which mattered. And I think that's reflective perhaps of the quality of counseling. It's not good enough to just have the conversation. You have to have the conversation in the way that the family member really understands and takes away the right message.
And how do you think it's best to do that, Dr. Mitchell? Are there techniques that are better suited to conveying that information, or should the clinician be trying to get feedback from the family member to ensure that they're understanding and not just go in, give a lecture, and then feel that they've done their duty?
Well, I think there are several. I think, first of all, that given what we know now with empiric data about what to expect in end-stage dementia, there is an opportunity for having these conversations more upstream rather than waiting for the actual problem, such as a feeding problem, to arise. So it gives an opportunity for the physicians, even a primary care provider, even a neurologist, to sit down quite early with patients even or family members and explain what happens towards the end stage of this disease. And the way I like to approach it is first establish what, after explaining that what the end stage of this disease looks like and that they possibly are nearing the end stage of the disease, try to understand what the goals of care are. And usually goals of care can be assessed as either that goal of being comfort, in other words, providing palliative care, rather than pursuing more aggressive interventions that may prolong life for another month or two but are uncomfortable, versus the idea of a goal of care being life prolongation at all costs. And I think most families, when they actually understand that their loved one is near the end of life, will opt for comfort.
I know a friend of mine who practices on the North Shore sees a fair number of nursing home patients. And is there one thing that he could do next week with his nursing home patients that as a result of your research, what would you suggest that he do?
Well, for this physician, I think, you know, our study really calls for improved communication with family members. So for any family members of even moderate stage, you know, before they get to the advanced stage, and particularly with the advanced stage patients, to really sit down with those families, make sure they're aware of what's expected in this end stage and that dementia is a terminal illness that will ultimately progress, and try to elicit those goals of care and try to imagine what kind of treatment they would want for particular problems that we know are going to arise, like infections or feeding problems, and make informed decisions about the treatments that are in concert and consistent with the established goals of care. The second thing, so communication, the study really calls for improved communication so that informed decisions can be made. The second thing that the physician could do, our study really calls for improved palliative care for patients with advanced dementia, including expert symptom management. And that can be accomplished either through greater access to the Medicare hospice benefit or improving skilled nursing home services that are directed towards palliation. So if this physician's nursing home has a contract with hospice and they like their hospice providers, when he sits down with those families, he might offer hospice care as another way of providing comfort care if that's their wishes. Alternatively, he might try if there's a palliative care services or consultant in his nursing home. That could be helpful. And, you know, he can also, if those don't exist, he might take some initiatives to creating either care plans, educational programs for the for the people in the facility providing care that really would give them better skilled services in palliation.
All right. Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Mitchell, for talking with me today about this.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening. You can reach Clinical Conversations at 1-617-440-4374, or you can write to me, jelia@nejm.org. Earlier podcasts are all available at podcasts.jwatch.org, where links for all stories can also be found. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time. Enough said.